descends just before they faint. I felt the blood rushing out of my head and heard buzzing in my ears. If I don't sit down, I thought, I'm going to collapse. How embarrassing would that be? My strong wife bearing the news stoically as her husband lay unconscious on the floor, the nurses trying to revive him with smelling salts. I half sat on the edge of the examining bench, holding Jenny's hand with one of mine and stroking her neck with the other. Tears welled in her eyes, but she didn't cry. Dr. Sherman, a tall, distinguished-looking man with a gruff but affable demeanor, confirmed that the fetus was dead. "We'd be able to see a heartbeat, no question," he said. He gently told us what we already knew from the books we had been reading, that 1 in 6 pregnancies ends in miscarriages, that this was nature's way of sorting out the weak, the retarded, the grossly deformed. Apparently remembering Jenny's worry about the flea sprays, he told us it was nothing we did or did not do. He placed his hand on Jenny's cheek and leaned in close as if to kiss her. "I'm sorry," he said. "You can try again in a couple of months." We both just sat there in silence. The blank videotape sitting on the bench beside us suddenly seemed like an incredible embarrassment. I wanted to hide it. I asked the doctor, "Where do we go from here?" "We had to remove the placenta," he said. "Years ago, you wouldn't have even known you had miscarried yet, and you would have waited until you started hemorrhaging." He gave us the option of waiting over the weekend and returning on Monday for the procedure, which was the same as an abortion, with the fetus and placenta being vacuumed from the uterus. But Jenny wanted to get it behind her, and so did I. "Okay, then," Dr. Sherman said. He gave her something to force her to dilate and was gone. Down the hall, we could hear him enter another exam room and boisterously greet an expectant mother with jolly banter. Alone in the room, Jenny and I fell heavily into each other's arms and stayed that way until a light knock came at the door. It was an older woman we had never seen before. She carried a sheaf of papers. "I'm sorry, sweetie," she said to Jenny. "I'm so sorry." And then she showed her where to sign the waiver acknowledging the risks of uterine suction. Afterwards, in the car, Jenny maintained a detached silence, pressing herself against the passenger door, gazing out the window. Her eyes were red, but she would not cry. I searched for comforting words without success. Really, what could be said? We had lost our baby. Yes, I could tell her we could try again. I could tell her that many couples go through the same thing. But she didn't want to hear it, and I didn't want to say it. Someday we would be able to see it all in perspective. But not today. When we arrived at the house, I helped Jenny inside and onto the couch, then went into the garage where Marley, as always, awaited our return with breathless anticipation. As soon as he saw me, he dove for his oversized rawhide bone and proudly paraded it around the room, his body wagging, tail whacking the washing machine like a mallet on a kettle drum. He begged me to try to snatch it from him. "Not today, pal," I said, and let him out the back door into the yard. He took a long pee and then came barreling back inside and careened down the hall searching for Jenny. It took me just a few seconds to follow him into the living room. When I turned the corner, I stopped short. I would have bet a week's pay that what I was looking at couldn't possibly happen. Our rambunctious, wired dog stood with his shoulders between Jenny's knees, his big, blocky head resting quietly in her lap. His tail hung flat between his legs, the first time I could remember it not wagging whenever he was touching one of us. His eyes were turned up at her, and he whimpered softly. She stroked his head a few times, and then, with no warning, buried her face in the thick fur of his neck and began sobbing. Hard, unrestrained, from the gut, sobbing. They stayed like that for a long time, Marley statue still, Jenny clutching him to her like an oversized doll. I stood off to the side, feeling like a voyeur, intruding on this private moment, not quite knowing what to do with myself. And then, without lifting her face, She raised one arm up toward me, and I joined her on the couch and wrapped my arms around her. There, the three of us stayed, locked in our embrace of shared grief. Chapter 7. Master and Beast. The next morning, a Saturday, I awoke before dawn to the sounds of Jenny softly sobbing beside me. "Hey," I said, and wrapped my arms around her. She nestled her face against my chest, and I could feel her tears soaking through my t-shirt. "I'm fine," she said, "really. I'm just, you know." I did know. I was trying to be the brave soldier, but I felt it too, the dull sense of loss and failure. It was odd. Less than 48 hours earlier, we had been bubbling with anticipation over our new baby. And now it was as if there had never been a pregnancy at all, as if the whole episode was just a dream from which we were having trouble waking. Later that day, I took Marley with me in the car to pick up a few groceries and some things Jenny needed at the pharmacy. On the way back, I stopped at a florist shop and bought a giant bouquet of spring flowers arranged in a vase, hoping they would cheer her up. I strapped them into the seatbelt in the back seat beside Marley so they wouldn't spill. When we got home a few minutes later, Jenny came out to meet us, and Marley tumbled out of the car to greet her. "We have a little surprise for you," I said. But when I reached in the back seat for the flowers, the surprise was on me. The bouquet was a mix of white daisies, yellow mums, assorted lilies, and bright red carnations. Now, however, the carnations were nowhere to be found. I looked more closely and found the decapitated stems that minutes earlier had held blossoms. Nothing else in the bouquet was disturbed. I glared at Marley, and he was dancing around like he was auditioning for Soul Train. When I finally caught him and pried open his jaws, I found the incontrovertible evidence of his guilt. Deep in his cavernous mouth, tucked up in one jowl like a wad of chewing tobacco, was a single red carnation. The others, presumably, were already down the hatch. I was ready to murder him. I looked up at Jenny and tears were streaming down her cheeks. But this time, they were tears of laughter. There was nothing left for me to do but laugh too. "That dog!" I've never been crazy about carnations anyway. Marley was so thrilled to see everyone happy and laughing again that he jumped up on his hind legs and did a breakdance for us. Chapter 8. A Battle of Wills. When Marley was not quite 6 months old, we signed him up for obedience classes. God knew he needed it. He was proving himself a challenging student, dense, wild, constantly distracted, a victim of his boundless nervous energy. As my father put it shortly after Marley attempted marital relations with his knee, "That dog's got a screw loose." We needed professional help. Our veterinarian told us about a local dog training club that offered basic obedience classes on Tuesday nights in the parking lot behind the armory. The teachers were unpaid volunteers from the club, serious amateurs who presumably had already taken their own dogs to the heights of advanced behavior modification. The course ran 8 lessons and cost $50, which we thought was a bargain, especially considering that Marley could destroy $50 worth of shoes in 30 seconds. And the club all but guaranteed we'd be marching home after graduation with the next great lassie. At registration, we met the woman who would be teaching our class. She was a stern, no-nonsense dog trainer who subscribed to the theory that there are no incorrigible dogs, just weak-willed and hapless owners. The first lesson seemed to prove her point. Before we were fully out of the car, Marley spotted the other dogs gathering with their owners across the tarmac. A party! He leaped over us and out of the car and was off in a tear, his leash dragging behind him. He darted from one dog to the next, sniffing private parts, dribbling pee, and flinging huge wads of spit through the air. For Marley, it was a festival of smells. So many genitals, so little time. I finally got within striking distance and took a giant leap, landing hard with both feet on his leash. He jerked backward, landed on his back, flipped around, and gazed up at me with the serene expression of a heroin addict who had just gotten his fix. Meanwhile, the instructor was staring at us with a look that could not have been more withering had I decided to throw off my clothes and dance naked right there on the blacktop. "Take your place, please." When she saw both Jenny and me tugging Marley into position, she added, "You are going to have to decide which of you is going to be trainer. A dog can only answer to one master." I began to protest, but she silenced me with that glare of hers. I suppose the same glare she used to intimidate her dogs into submission. And I slinked off to the sidelines with my tail between my legs, leaving Master Jenny in command. This was probably a mistake. Marley was already considerably stronger than Jenny, and knew it. Miss Dominatrix was only a few sentences into her introduction on the importance of establishing dominance over our pets when Marley decided the standard poodle on the opposite side of the class deserved a closer look. He lunged off with Jenny in tow. All the other dogs were sitting placidly beside their masters at tidy 10-foot intervals, awaiting further instructions. Jenny was fighting valiantly to plant her feet and bring Marley to a halt, but he lumbered on in pursuit of hot poodle butt-sniffing action. My wife looked amazingly like a water skier being towed behind a powerboat. Everyone stared. Some snickered. I covered my eyes. Marley wasn't one for formal introductions. He crashed into the poodle and immediately crammed his nose between her legs. After Marley had given the poodle a full gynecological examination, Jenny was able to drag him back into place. Miss Dominatrix announced calmly, "That class is an example of a dog that has been allowed to think he is the alpha male of his pack. Right now, he's in charge." As if to drive home the point, Marley attacked his tail, spinning wildly, his jaws snapping at thin air, and in the process he wrapped the leash around Jenny's ankles until she was fully immobilized. I winced for her and gave thanks that it wasn't me out there. The instructor began running the class through the sit and down commands. Jenny would firmly order, "Sit," and Marley would jump up on her and put his paws on her shoulders. She would press his butt to the ground, and he would roll over for a belly rub. She would try to tug him into place, and he would grab the leash in his teeth, shaking his head from side to side as if he were wrestling a python. It was too painful to watch. At one point, I opened my eyes to see Jenny lying on the pavement face down, and Marley standing over her, panting happily. Later, she told me, she was trying to show him the down command. As class ended and Jenny and Marley rejoined me, Miss Dominatrix intercepted us. "You really need to get control over that animal," she said with a sneer. Well, thank you for that valuable advice, and to think, we had signed up simply to provide comic relief for the rest of the class. Neither of us breathed a word. We just retreated to the car in humiliation. Finally, I said, "One thing you can say for him. He sure loves school." The next week, Marley and I were back, this time without Jenny. When I suggested to her that I was probably the closest thing to an alpha dog we were going to find in our home, she gladly relinquished her brief title as master and commander and vowed to never show her face in public again. Before leaving the house, I flipped Marley over on his back, towered over him, and growled in my most intimidating voice, "I'm the boss! You're not the boss! I'm the boss! Got it, alpha dog?" He thumped his tail on the floor and tried to gnaw on my wrists. The night's lesson was walking on heel, one I was especially keen on mastering. I was tired of fighting Marley every step of every walk. He already had yanked Jenny off her feet once when he took off after a cat, leaving her with bloody knees. It was time he learned to trot placidly along by our sides. I wrestled him to our spot on the tarmac. Miss Dominatrix handed each of us a short length of chain with a steel ring welded to each end. These, she told us, were choker collars and would be our secret weapons for teaching our dogs to heal effortlessly at our sides. The choker chain was brilliantly simple in design. When the dog behaved and walked beside its master as it was supposed to, with slack in its lead, the chain hung limply around its neck. But if the dog lunged forward or veered off course, the chain tightened like a noose, choking the errant hound into gasping submission. It didn't take long, our instructor promised, before dogs learned to submit or die of asphyxia. Wickedly delicious, I thought. I started to slip the choker chain over Marley's head, but he saw it coming and grabbed it in his teeth. I pried his jaws open to pull it out and tried again. He grabbed it again. All the other dogs had their chains on. Everyone was waiting. I grabbed his muzzle with one hand and with the other tried to lasso the chain over his snout. He was pulling backward, trying to get his mouth open so he could attack the mysterious coiled silver snake again. I finally forced the chain over his head, and he dropped to the ground, thrashing and snapping, his paws in the air, his head jerking from side to side, until he managed to get the chain in his teeth again. I looked up at the teacher. "He likes it," I said. As instructed, I got Marley to his feet and got the chain out of his mouth. Then, as instructed, I pushed his butt down into a sit position and stood beside him, my left leg brushing his right shoulder. On the count of three, I was to say, "Marley, heel," and step off with my left, never my right, foot. If he began to wander off course, a series of minor corrections, sharp little tugs on the leash, would bring him back into line. "Class, on the count of three," Miss Dominatrix called out. "Marley, heel," I commanded. As soon as I took my first step, he took off like a fighter jet from an aircraft carrier. I yanked back hard on the leash, and he made an awful, coughing gasp as the chain tightened around his airway. He sprang back for an instant, but as soon as the chain loosened, he lunged forward again. I yanked back, and he gasped once more. We continued like this the entire length of the parking lot, Marley yanking ahead, me yanking back, each time with increasing vigor. He was coughing and panting. I was grunting and sweating. "Rein that dog in!" Miss Dominatrix yelled. I tried to with all my might, but the lesson wasn't sinking in. The instructor had the class queue up and try it again. Once again, Marley lurched his way manically across the blacktop, eyes bulging, strangling himself as he went. At the other end, Miss Dominatrix held Marley and me up to the class as an example of how not to heal a dog. "Here," she said impatiently, holding out her hand, "let me show you." I handed the leash to her, and she efficiently tugged Marley around into position, pulling up on the choker as she ordered him to sit. Sure enough, he sank back on his haunches, eagerly looking up at her. "Damn." With a smart yank of the lead, Miss Dominatrix set off with him, but almost instantly he barreled ahead as if he were pulling the lead sled in the Iditarod. The instructor corrected hard, pulling him off balance. He stumbled, wheezed, then lunged forward again. It looked like he was going to pull her arm out of its socket. I should have been embarrassed, but I felt an odd sort of satisfaction that often comes with vindication. She wasn't having any more success than I was. My classmates snickered, and I beamed with perverse pride. "See? My dog is awful for everyone, not just me." Now that I wasn't the one being made the fool, I had to admit, the scene was pretty hilarious. The two of them, having reached the end of the parking lot, turned and came lurching back toward us in fits and starts, Miss Dominatrix scowling with what clearly was apoplectic rage, Marley joyous beyond words. She yanked furiously at the leash, and Marley, frothing at the mouth, yanked back harder still, clearly enjoying this excellent new tug-of-war game his teacher had called on him to demonstrate. When he caught sight of me, he hit the gas. With a near supernatural burst of adrenaline, he made a dash for me, forcing Miss Dominatrix to break into a sprint to keep from being pulled off her feet. Marley didn't stop until he slammed into me with his usual joie de vivre. Miss Dominatrix shot me a look that told me I had crossed some invisible line. Marley had made a mockery of everything she preached about dogs and discipline. He had publicly humiliated her. She handed the leash back to me and, turning to the class, as if this unfortunate little episode had never occurred, said, "Okay, class, on the count of three." When the lesson was over, she asked if I could stay after for a minute. I waited with Marley as she patiently fielded questions from other students in the class. When the last one had left, she turned to me and, in a newly conciliatory voice, said, "I think your dog is still a little young for structured obedience training." "He's a handful, isn't he?" I said, feeling a new camaraderie with her now that we'd shared the same humiliating experience. "He's simply not ready for this." It was beginning to dawn on me what she was getting at. "Are you trying to tell me he's a distraction to the other dogs? That you're... he's just too excitable. Kicking us out of class? You can always bring him back in another 6 or 8 months. So you're kicking us out." "I'll happily give you a full refund." "You're kicking us out." "Yes, I'm kicking you out." Marley, as if on cue, lifted his leg and let loose a raging stream of urine, missing his beloved instructor's foot by mere centimeters. Sometimes a man needs to get angry to get serious. First thing the next morning, I had Marley out in the backyard with me. "Nobody kicks the Grogan boys out of obedience school," I told him. "Untrainable? We'll see who's untrainable. Right?" He bounced up and down. "Can we do it, Marley?" "I can't hear you. Can we do it?" he yelped. "That's better. Now let's get to work." We started with the sit command, which I had been practicing with him since he was a small puppy, and which he already was quite good at. Next, we moved to the down command, another one I had been practicing with him. I slowly raised my hand in the air and held it there as he waited for the word. With a sharp downward motion, I snapped my fingers and pointed at the ground and said, "Down!" Marley collapsed in a heap, hitting the ground with a thud. He could not possibly have gone down with more gusto had a mortar shell just exploded behind him. Jenny, sitting on the porch with her coffee, noticed it too and yelled out, "Incoming!" After several rounds of hit the deck, I decided to move up to the next challenge, come on command. This was a tough one for Marley. The coming part was not the problem. It was waiting in place until we summoned him. I put him in the sit position, facing me, and fixed my eyes on his. As we stared at each other, I raised my palm, holding it out in front of me like a crossing guard. "Stay," I said, and took a step backward. He froze, staring anxiously, waiting for the slightest sign that he could join me. On my fourth step backward, he could take it no longer and broke free, racing up and tumbling against me. I admonished him and tried it again, and again, and again. Each time he allowed me to get a little farther away before charging. Eventually, I stood 50 feet across the yard, my palm out toward him. I could see the nervous energy building in him. He was like a volcano, ready to blow. But he held fast. "Okay, enough torture," I thought. I dropped my hand and yelled, "Marley, come!" As he catapulted forward, I squatted and clapped my hands to encourage him. "Come on, boy," I coached. "Come on!" And come he did. He was barreling right at me. "Slow it down, boy," I said. He just kept coming. "Slow down!" He had this vacant, crazed look on his face, and in the instant before impact, I realized the pilot had left the wheelhouse. It was a one-dog stampede. I had time for one final command. "Stop!" I screamed. Blam! He plowed into me without breaking stride, and I pitched backward, slamming hard to the ground. When I opened my eyes a few seconds later, he was straddling me with all four paws, lying on my chest and desperately licking my face. "How did I do, boss?" Technically speaking, he had followed orders exactly. After all, I had failed to mention anything about stopping once he got to me. Jenny peered out the kitchen window at us and shouted, "I'm off to work! When you two are done making out, don't forget to close the windows. It's supposed to rain this afternoon." I gave Linebacker Dog a snack, then showered and headed off to work myself. When I arrived home that night, Jenny was waiting for me at the front door, and I could tell she was upset. "Go look in the garage," she said. I opened the door into the garage, and the first thing I spotted was Marley, lying on his carpet, looking dejected. In that instant snapshot image, I could see that his snout and front paws were not right. They were dark brown, not their usual light yellow, caked in dried blood. Then my focus zoomed out, and I sucked in my breath. The garage, our indestructible bunker, was a shambles. Throw rugs were shredded, paint was clawed off the concrete walls. Worst of all, the doorway in which I stood looked like it had been attacked with a chipper shredder. Bits of wood were sprayed in a 10-foot semicircle around the door, which was gouged halfway through to the other side. The bottom 3 feet of the door jamb were missing entirely and nowhere to be found. Blood streaked the walls from where Marley had shredded his paws and muzzle. My mind flashed to poor Mrs. Niedermeyer and the chainsaw murder across the street. I felt like I was standing in the middle of a crime scene. Jenny's voice came from behind me. "When I came home for lunch, everything was fine, but I could tell it was getting ready to rain." After she was back at work, an intense storm moved through, bringing with it sheets of rain, dazzling flashes of lightning, and thunder so powerful you could almost feel it thump against your chest. When she arrived home a couple hours later, Marley, standing amid the carnage of his desperate escape attempt, was in a complete, panic-stricken lather. He was so pathetic she couldn't bring herself to yell at him. Besides, the incident was over. He would have no idea what he was being punished for. Over dinner, we tried to put what we were now calling the wilding in perspective. All we could figure was that, alone and terrified as the storm descended on the neighborhood, Marley decided his best chance at survival was to begin digging his way into the house. He was probably listening to some ancient denning instinct handed down from his ancestor, the wolf. And he pursued his goal with a zealous efficiency I wouldn't have thought possible without the aid of heavy machinery. When the dishes were done, Jenny and I went out into the garage where Marley, back to his old self, grabbed a chew toy and bounced around us, looking for a little tug-of-war action. I held him still while Jenny sponged the blood off his fur. Then he watched us, tail wagging, as we cleaned up his handiwork and made a list of materials we would need from the hardware store to repair the damage, the first of countless such repairs I would end up making over the course of his life. Marley seemed positively ebullient to have us out there lending a hand with his remodeling efforts. "You don't have to look so happy about it," I scowled, and brought him inside for the night. Chapter 9. The Stuff Males Are Made Of. Every dog needs a good veterinarian. Every new dog owner needs one too, mostly for the advice and reassurance. Jay Butan, Dr. Jay to all who knew him, was young, smart, hip, and extraordinarily kind. Now, on this afternoon, Jenny and I stood in an exam room with him discussing Marley's deepening neurosis over thunderstorms. We had hoped the chipper shredder incident in the garage was an isolated aberration, but it turned out to be just the beginning of what would become a lifelong pattern of phobic, irrational behavior. Even the hint of a storm would throw Marley into a meltdown. If we were home, he would press against us, shaking and drooling uncontrollably, his eyes darting nervously, ears folded back, tail tucked between his legs. When he was alone, he turned destructive, gouging away at whatever stood between him and perceived safety. Dr. J pressed a vial of small yellow pills into my hand and said, "Don't hesitate to use these." They were sedatives that would, as he put it, take the edge off Marley's anxiety. The hope, he said, was that aided by the calming effect of the drug, Marley would be able to more rationally cope with storms and eventually realize they were nothing but a lot of harmless noise. Dr. J scruffed Marley's neck. "And you probably want to start thinking seriously about having him neutered." "Neutered?" I repeated. "You mean as in..." I looked down at the enormous set of testicles, comically huge orbs, swinging between Marley's hind legs. Dr. J gazed down at them too, and nodded. Lately, Marley, who was 7 months old, had begun humping anything that moved, including our dinner guest. "It'll just remove all that nervous sexual energy and make him a happier, calmer dog," he said. He promised it wouldn't dampen Marley's sunny exuberance. "I don't know. What about siring a litter?" Again, Dr. J seemed to be choosing his words carefully. "I think you need to be realistic about that," he said. "Marley's a great family pet, but I'm not sure he's got the credentials he would need to be in demand for stud." He was being as diplomatic as possible, but the expression on his face gave him away. It almost screamed out, "Good God, man! For the sake of future generations, we must contain this genetic mistake at all costs!" I told him we would think about it, and with our new supply of mood-altering drugs in hand, we headed home. It was at the same time as we debated slicing away Marley's manhood that Jenny was placing unprecedented demands on mine. Dr. Sherman had cleared her to try to get pregnant again. The days of simply putting away the birth control pills and letting whatever might happen happen were behind us. In the insemination wars, Jenny was going on the offensive. For that, she needed me, a key ally, who controlled the flow of ammunition. Like most males, I had spent every waking moment from the age of 15 trying to convince the opposite sex that I was a worthy mating partner. Finally, I had someone who agreed. I should have been thrilled. For the first time in my life, a woman wanted me more than I wanted her. But suddenly, it was not a rollicking good romp that Jenny craved for me. It was a baby. That most joyous of acts overnight became a clinical drill involving basal temperature checks, menstrual calendars, and ovulation charts. It was all about as arousing as a tax audit. I would be, let's say, fixing the garbage disposal, and she would walk in with her calendar in hand and say, "I had my last period on the 17th, which means..." And she would pause to count ahead from that date. "That we need to do it now!" One morning when I was working in my newspaper's West Palm Beach bureau, just 10 minutes from home, Jenny called from work. Did I want to meet her at home for lunch? Then she added, "Today's a good day. I think I'm ovulating." A wave of dread washed over me. Oh, God, no. Not the O word. The pressure was on. It was time to perform or perish. To quite literally rise or fall. "Please don't make me," I wanted to plead into the phone. Instead, I said as coolly as I could, "Sure. Does 12:30 work?" When I opened the front door, Marley, as always, was there to greet me, but Jenny was nowhere to be found. I called out to her. "In the bathroom," she answered. "Out in a sec." I sorted through the mail, killing time, a general sense of doom hovering over me, the way I imagined it hovered over people waiting for their biopsy results. "Hey there, sailor," a voice behind me said. And when I turned around, Jenny was standing there in a little silky two-piece thing. Her flat stomach peeked out from below the top, which hung precariously from her shoulders by two impossibly thin straps. Her legs had never looked longer. "How do I look?" she said, holding her hands out at her sides. She looked incredible. That's how she looked. I could tell she felt silly in this seductive getup, but it was having the intended effect. She scampered into the bedroom with me in pursuit. Soon we were on top of the sheets in each other's arms. I closed my eyes and could feel that old lost friend of mine stirring. The magic was returning. My fingers fumbled for those flimsy shoulder straps. I could feel her breath now, hot and moist on my face, and heavy. Hot, moist, heavy breath. Sexy. But wait, what was that smell? Something on her breath. Something at once familiar and foreign, not exactly unpleasant, but not quite enticing either. I almost had it. It was milk bones? Yes, milk bones. That was it. But why has Jenny been eating milk bones? And besides, I could feel her lips on my neck. How could she be kissing my neck and breathing in my face all at once? It didn't make any... Oh, my God. I opened my eyes. There, inches from my face, filling my entire frame of vision, loomed Marley's huge head. He was panting up a storm, drool soaking into the sheets. His eyes were half closed, and he looked entirely too in love. "Bad dog!" I shrieked, recoiling across the bed. "No! No! Go to bed!" It was too late. The magic was gone. The next morning, I made an appointment to take Marley in to have his balls cut off. I figured if I wasn't going to have sex for the rest of my life, he wasn't either. Dr. J said we could drop Marley off before we went to work and pick him up on our way home. A week later, that's just what we did. As Jenny and I got ready, Marley caromed happily off the walls, sensing an impending outing. For Marley, any trip was a good trip. It didn't matter where we were going or for how long. Take out the trash? No problem. Walk to the corner for a gallon of milk? Count me in. I began to feel pangs of guilt. He trusted us to do the right thing, and here we were, secretly plotting to emasculate him. And I felt even worse when I whistled for him and he bounded out the door and into the car with utter blind faith that I would not steer him wrong. Jenny drove and I sat in the passenger seat. Marley was riding shotgun with his two best friends. Did life get any better than this? I cracked my window, and soon he had squirmed his way fully onto my lap and pressed his nose firmly into the narrow crack of the window. Oh, why not, I thought. This was his last ride as a fully equipped member of the male gender. He was enjoying the sensation so much, I opened the window farther, and soon his entire head was out. His ears flapped behind him in the wind, and his tongue hung out like he was drunk on the ether of the city. God, was he happy. As we drove down Dixie Highway, I noticed, more with curiosity than alarm, that Marley had hooked both of his front paws over the edge of the half-open window. And now his neck and upper shoulders were hanging out of the car, too. He just needed a pair of goggles and a silk scarf to look like one of those World War I flying aces. "John, he's making me nervous." "He's fine. He just wants a little fresh." At that instant, he slid his front legs out the window until his armpits were resting on the edge of the glass. "John, grab him! Grab him!" Before I could do anything, Marley was off my lap and scrambling out the window of our moving car. His butt was up in the air, his hind legs clawing for a foothold. He was making his break. As his body slithered past me, I lunged for him and managed to grab the end of his tail with my left hand. Jenny was braking hard in heavy traffic. Marley dangled fully outside the moving car, suspended upside down by his tail, which I had by the most tenuous of grips. My body was twisted around in a position that didn't allow me to get my other hand on him. Marley was frantically trotting along with his front paws on the pavement. Jenny got the car stopped in the outside lane with cars lining up behind us, horns blaring. "Now what?" I yelled. I was stuck. I couldn't pull him back in the window. I couldn't open the door. I couldn't get my other arm out. And I didn't dare let go of him, or he would surely dash in the path of one of the angry drivers swerving around us. I held on for dear life, my face scrunched against the glass, just inches from his giant, flapping scrotum. Jenny put the flashers on and ran around to my side, where she grabbed him and held him by the collar until I could get out and help her wrestle him back into the car. Our little drama had unfolded directly in front of a gas station, and as Jenny got the car back into gear, I looked over to see that all the mechanics had come out to take in the show. I thought they were going to wet themselves, they were laughing so hard. "Thanks, guys," I called out. "Glad we could brighten your morning." When we got to the clinic, I walked Marley in on a tight leash, just in case he tried any more smart moves. My guilt was gone, my resolve hardened. In the waiting area, he was able to terrorize a couple of cats and tip over a stand filled with pamphlets. I turned him over to Dr. J's assistant and said, "Give him the works." That night, when I picked him up, Marley was a changed dog. He was sore from the surgery and moved gingerly. His eyes were bloodshot and droopy from the anesthesia, and he was still groggy. And where those magnificent crown jewels of his had swung so proudly, there was nothing. Just a small, shriveled flap of skin. The irrepressible Marley bloodline had officially and forever come to an end. Chapter 10. The Luck of the Irish. Our lives increasingly were being defined by work. Work at the newspapers, work on the house, work trying to get pregnant, and, nearly a full-time vocation in itself, work raising Marley. We hadn't even reached our second wedding anniversary, and already we were feeling the grind of responsible, grown-up, married life. We needed to get away. We needed a vacation, just the two of us. I surprised Jenny one evening with two tickets to Ireland. We would be gone for 3 weeks. There would be no itineraries, no guided tours, no must-see destinations, only a rental car, a road map, and a guide to bed and breakfast inns along the way. Just having the tickets in hand lifted a yoke from our shoulders. First, we had a few duties to dole out, and at the top of the list was Marley. We quickly ruled out a boarding kennel. He was too young, too wired, too rambunctious to be cooped up in a pen 23 hours a day. As Dr. J had predicted, neutering had not diminished Marley's exuberance one bit. We made a list of every friend, neighbor, and co-worker we could think of, then one by one crossed off names. Eventually, we were left with just one. Kathy worked in my office and was single and unattached. She grew up in the rural Midwest, loved animals, and longed to someday trade in her small apartment for a house with a yard. Best of all, she said yes. Ireland was everything we dreamed it would be, beautiful, bucolic, lazy. We simply wandered, bumping our way along the coast. All of our duties and obligations back home were just distant memories. As evening approached each day, we would begin looking for a place to spend the night. Invariably, these were rooms in private homes run by sweet Irish widows who doted on us, served us tea, turned down our sheets, and always seemed to ask us the same questions. "So, would you two be planning to start a family soon?" Jenny and I became convinced there was a national law in Ireland that required all guest beds to face a large, wall-mounted likeness of either the Pope or the Virgin Mary. Some places provided both. The Irish celibate traveler law also dictated that all guest beds be extremely creaky, sounding a rousing alarm every time one of its occupants so much as rolled over. Suddenly, sex seemed so illicit. To risk sex in these surroundings was to risk shameful humiliation at the communal breakfast table the next morning. It was to risk Mrs. O'Flaherty's raised eyebrow as she served up eggs and fried tomatoes, asking with a leering grin, "So, was the bed comfortable for you, too?" Ireland was a coast-to-coast, no-sex zone. And that was all the invitation I needed. We spent the trip bopping like bunnies. Still, Jenny couldn't stop fretting about her big baby back home. Every few days, she would feed a fistful of coins into a payphone and call home for a progress report from Kathy. I would stand outside the booth and listen to Jenny's end of the conversation. "He did? Seriously? Right into traffic? You weren't hurt, were you? Oh, thank God. I would have screamed too. What? Your shoes? Oh, no. And your purse? And he what? Wet cement, you say? What's the chance of that happening?" And so it would go. Each call was a litany of transgressions, one worse than the next, many of which surprised even us, hardened survivors of the puppy wars. When we arrived home, Marley raced outside to greet us. Kathy stood in the doorway, looking tired and strained. She had the faraway gaze of a shell-shocked soldier after a particularly unrelenting battle. Her bag was packed and sitting on the front porch, ready to go. She held her car key in her hand, as if she could not wait to escape. We gave her gifts and thanked her profusely. She excused herself politely and was gone. As best as we could figure, Kathy had been unable to exert any authority at all over Marley, and even less control. With each victory, he grew bolder. He forgot all about healing, dragging her behind him wherever he wished to go. He grabbed whatever suited him, shoes, purses, pillows, and would not let go. He stole food off her plate. He even tried taking over her bed. "Poor Kathy," Jenny said. "She looked kind of broken, don't you think?" "Shattered is more like it. We probably shouldn't ask her to dog sit for us again." "No," I answered. "That probably wouldn't be a good idea." The next morning, Jenny and I both started back to work. But first, I slipped the choker chain around Marley's neck and took him for a walk. He immediately lunged forward, not even pretending to try to heal. "A little rusty, are we? Okay, let's try this again. Marley, heel!" I ordered. By the end of the walk, my grip on the leash so tight that my knuckles had turned white, I finally managed to convince him I wasn't fooling around. If he wanted to lurch, I would choke him. If he wanted to cooperate and walk by my side, I would loosen my grip, and he would barely feel the chain around his neck. Lurch, choke, heel, breathe. It was simple enough for even Marley to grasp. As we turned into the driveway, my recalcitrant dog trotted along beside me, not perfectly, but respectably. For the first time in his life, he was actually healing, or at least attempting a close proximity of it. I would take it as a victory. "Oh, yes," I sang joyously, "the boss is back." Several days later, Jenny called me at the office. She had just been to see Dr. Sherman. "Luck of the Irish," she said. "Here we go again." Chapter 11. The Things He Ate. This pregnancy was different. Our miscarriage had taught us some important lessons, and this time we had no intention of repeating our mistakes. Most important, we kept our news the most closely guarded secret since D-Day. Except for Jenny's doctors and nurses, no one, not even our parents, was brought into our confidence. In addition to the secrecy, we were simply more measured in our excitement, even when we were alone. We began sentences with conditional clauses, such as, "If everything works out." We didn't dare let our joy out of check, lest it turn and bite us. Jenny rose at dawn each morning and took Marley for a brisk walk along the water. My wife was the picture of robust health in all ways but one. She spent most days, all day long, on the verge of throwing up. But she wasn't complaining. She greeted each wave of nausea with what can only be described as gleeful acceptance, for it was a sign that the tiny experiment inside her was chugging along just fine. Indeed, it was. This time around, Essie took my videotape and recorded the first faint, grainy images of our baby. We could hear the heart beating, see its four tiny chambers pulsing. We could trace the outline of the head and count all four limbs. Dr. Sherman popped his head into the sonogram room to pronounce everything perfect, and then looked at Jenny and said in that booming voice of his, "What are you crying for, kid? You're supposed to be happy." Essie whacked him with her clipboard and scolded, "You go away and leave her alone." Then rolled her eyes at Jenny as if to say, "Men, they are so clueless." When it came to dealing with pregnant wives, clueless would describe me. I gave Jenny her space, sympathized with her in her nausea and pain. I even tried my best to indulge her increasingly bizarre and irrational behavior. I was soon on a first-name basis with the overnight clerk at the 24-hour market, as I stopped in at all hours for ice cream, or apples, or celery, or chewing gum in flavors I never knew existed. "Are you sure this is clove? She says it has to be clove." As the pregnancy progressed, so did Marley's training. I worked with him every day, and now I was able to entertain our friends by yelling, "Incoming!" and watching him crash to the floor, all four limbs splayed. He came consistently on command, unless there was something riveting his attention, such as another dog, cat, squirrel, butterfly, mailman, or floating weed seed. He sat consistently, unless he felt strongly like standing, and heeled reliably, unless there was something so tempting it was worth strangling himself over. See dogs, cats, squirrels, etc. He was coming along, but that's not to say he was mellowing into a calm, well-behaved dog. If I towered over him and barked stern orders, he would obey, sometimes even eagerly. But his default setting was stuck on eternal incorrigibility. Jenny and I had the foolish notion that it would be nice to have a dog we could trust to be alone in the house for short periods. Locking him in the bunker every time we stepped out was becoming tedious, and as Jenny said, "What's the point of having a dog if he can't greet you at the door when you get home?" We knew full well we didn't dare leave him in the house unaccompanied if there was any possibility of a rainstorm. Even with his doggy downers, he still proved himself capable of digging quite energetically for China. When the weather was clear, though, we didn't want to have to lock him in the garage every time we stepped out for a few minutes. We began leaving him briefly while we ran to the store or dropped by a neighbor's house. Sometimes he did just fine and we would return to find the house unscathed. On these days, we would spot his black nose pushing through the mini-blinds as he stared out the living room window waiting for us. Other days, he didn't do quite so well, and we usually knew trouble awaited us before we even opened the door, because he was not at the window, but off hiding somewhere. In Jenny's 6 month of pregnancy, we returned after being away for less than an hour to find Marley under the bed. At his size, he really had to work to get under there. Looking like he just murdered the mailman. Guilt radiated off him. The house seemed fine, but we knew he was hiding some dark secret, and we walked from room to room trying to ascertain just what he had done wrong. Then I noticed that the foam cover to one of the stereo speakers was missing. We looked everywhere for it. Gone without a trace. Marley just might have gotten away with it had I not found incontrovertible evidence of his guilt when I went on poop patrol the next morning. Remnants of the speaker cover surfaced for days. During our next outing, Marley surgically removed the woofer cone from the same speaker. The speaker wasn't knocked over or in any way amiss. The paper cone was simply gone, as if someone had sliced it out with a razor blade. Eventually, he got around to doing the same thing to the other speaker. Another time, we came home to find that our four-legged footstool, was now three-legged, and there was no sign whatsoever, not a single splinter, of the missing limb. For the most part, we were philosophical about the damage. In every dog owner's life, a few cherished family heirlooms must fall. Only once was I ready to slice them open to retrieve what was rightfully mine. For her birthday, I bought Jenny an 18-karat gold necklace, a delicate chain with a tiny clasp, and she immediately put it on. But a few hours later, she pressed her hand to her throat and screamed, "My necklace! It's gone!" The clasp must have given out or never been fully secured. "Don't panic," I told her. "We haven't left the house. It's got to be right here somewhere." We began scouring the house, room by room. As we searched, I gradually became aware that Marley was more rambunctious than usual. I straightened up and looked at him. He was squirming like a centipede. When he noticed I had him in my sights, he began evasive action. Oh no, I thought. The Marley Mambo. It could mean only one thing. "What's that?" Jenny asked, panic rising in her voice. "Hanging out of his mouth." It was thin and delicate and gold. "No sudden moves," she ordered, her voice dropping to a whisper. We both froze. "Okay, boy, it's all right," I coaxed, like a hostage negotiator. Instinctively, Jenny and I began to circle him from opposite directions, moving with glacial slowness. It was as if he were wired with high explosives, and one false move could set him off. "Easy, Marley," Jenny said in her calmest voice. "Easy now. Drop the necklace and nobody gets hurt." Marley eyed us suspiciously, his head darting back and forth between us. We had him cornered, but he knew he had something we wanted. "Drop it, Marley," I whispered, taking another small step forward. His whole body began to wag. I crept forward by degrees. Almost imperceptibly, Jenny closed in on his flank. We were within striking distance. We glanced at each other and knew, without speaking, what to do. We were less than 2 feet away from him. I nodded to Jenny and silently mouthed, "On three." But before we could make our move, he threw his head back and made a loud smacking sound. The tail end of the chain, which had been dangling out of his mouth, disappeared. We dove. I forced his jaws open and pushed my whole hand into his mouth and down his throat. I probed every flap and crevice and came up empty. "It's too late. He swallowed it." Jenny began slapping him on the back. "Cough it up, damn it!" But it was no use. The best she got out of him was a loud, satisfied burp. Marley may have won the battle, but we knew it was just a matter of time before we won the war. Nature's call was on our side. Sooner or later, what went in had to come out. As disgusting as the thought was, I knew if I poked through his excrement long enough, I would find it. Had it been, say, a silver chain or a gold-plated chain, something of any less value, my queasiness might have won out. But this chain was solid gold and had set me back a decent chunk of pay. Grossed out or not, I was going in. For 3 days, instead of tossing his piles over the fence, I carefully placed each on a wide board in the grass and poked it with a tree branch while I sprayed with a garden hose, gradually washing the digested material away into the grass and leaving behind any foreign objects. I felt like a gold miner working a sluice and coming up with a treasure trove of swallowed junk, from shoelaces to guitar picks, but no necklace. Shouldn't it have come out by now? On the 4th day, I was about to give up when I spotted something odd. A small brown lump, about the size of a lima bean. It wasn't even close to being large enough to be the missing jewelry, yet clearly it did not belong there. As the water washed it clean, I got a glimmer of something exceptionally bright and shiny. Eureka! I had struck gold. The necklace was impossibly compressed, many times smaller than I would have guessed possible. It was as though some unknown alien power had sucked it into a mysterious dimension of space and time before spitting it out again, good as new. No, actually, better than new. Marley's stomach acids had done an amazing job. It was the most brilliant gold I had ever seen. Man, I said with a whistle, we should open a jewelry cleaning business. We can make a killing with the Dowagers in Palm Beach, Jenny agreed, and went off to disinfect her recovered birthday present. She wore that gold chain for years, and every time I looked at it, I had the same vivid flashback to my brief and ultimately successful career in gold speculation. Chapter 12. Welcome to the Indigent Ward. You don't give birth to your first child every day, and so when St. Mary's Hospital in West Palm Beach offered us the option of paying extra for a luxury birthing suite, we jumped at the chance.